Applying Yakima High School Little Manual Grade Expectation, Grant to Helpway, Empire of the Senses, in the North of Identity, My Mother Dual Allergy, from which she got optimized, and in her criticism. Kathy Ackle, I think, has become the most about it when a party night people are talking about it. One of the most exciting things about her work, I think, is the way in which it makes us reflect on the conditions of our own time and the conditions of living in the present. Today, she's going to talk about a task that I think is very important to her work, Emily Grant of Reverend Heights, and the right back to some other issues with her work. So, welcome.
Okay, this is going to be really informal, and that's all I have in notes that I'm going to be talking from. So I might just sit down and stand up so you feel more comfortable. I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do, because you decide to stay or not, or what you do that. What I'm going to do is I want to talk finally about what I see as, well, for me, a very important tradition of writing, which, you know, for me personally, it's the most important or interesting tradition right now. I mean, it's what I feel I'm writing out. The way I want to talk about this tradition is I want to start out with a text of one show. There'll be three parts to this. And do a very simple reading of it. It's one show, but it's not much else I can do with them. I want to do this reading of the Blanchot text in order to set up a language in which I want to look at Wuthering Heights, which will be the second part of the lecture. It won't be as long as we are. These two parts, I don't know how long it will take, because I only have notes. And I hope you won't get too bored, because it's really, I just want to do very simple exegesis. I'm doing this in order to set up a certain language, which if I set up the language without doing this, to me, I need to look at text, I need to see that. And once I set up this language, then I want to make certain whatever remarks, talk a little about what I see in this tradition. But I need this language to talk about it, otherwise I'm just saying very empty generalization. So I hope if you get bored, you want to but this might take a while. Okay, I'm using the first, here's a book of two essays by Maurice Blanchot called The Unavowable Community. And I'm using the first part of it, which is Blanchot on the work of George Bataille. And the essay, Blanchot, and I think this is a very one way of going at Blanchot's position. The main thing I want to examine are the terms freedom and democracy and the relationships between I and the other. That's why I'm using this text. Blanchot begins talking about equality. The reason he does is this text was written at the time in France when communism was just moving into Stalinism. And I'm sure you all know this. And the big question for all of the French intellectuals at the time who were communists, I mean, you come out of Breton surrealism, and Bataille's first group counterattack was formed with André Breton, was that they began to question communism. They still saw that there was need, democracy wasn't even a question. There was a belief that there was a need for a community in which everyone had rights to, work, a decent life, et cetera, et cetera. I think things are the same now. I don't reason to think. These issues are still of prime importance, and we still have the same questions. What are possible models for community? Okay. Begins with a quote by Edgar Morin that talks about communism. Communism is the major question and the principal experience of my life. So this is where we're going to begin with communism. I have never stopped, I have never stopped expressing myself in the aspirations it expresses, and I still believe in the possibility of another society and another humanity. So there you are. With the fall of communism, with the questioning, we're still looking for a community, for humanity. We haven't let those we are totally abandoned, those aspirations. Okay. Monchot begins. He says that equality is the foundation of communism and of democracy, in that, quote, there can be no community until the needs of men are equally fulfilled. I'm going to use the word men and male here, something in the names of words use that progression. Okay, and he says that this equality is linked to what Jean-Luc Nancy calls an imminent humanity. What we're talking about is that humanity's center, even more important, this is the Renaissance model, you know, where the eye, the human eye, is the center of the picture, and all perspective depends on the human eye. That I and you are the center of our lives and of the world. We control things, we make things. Right? And that, according to Blanchot, in this idea of this imminent humanity, of equality, quote, and I find this, you know, this is the sort of quote that sort of made me think and led me in this direction, like, my God. Quote, herein lies the healthy origin of the sickest totalitarianism. And in a way, the rest of what I have to say would be an explication of this. Herein lies the healthy origin of the sickest totalitarianism. I think it's pretty important to talk about today when the notion of democracy must be questioned. What is actually going on in this country? What kind of government do we actually have? As a further definition of human imminency, the idea that man is all that matters, or man is highest in the hierarchy. Blanchot says, the individual affirms himself with his inalienable rights. Memories for us of our Constitution. His refusal to have any origin other than himself. His indifference towards any theoretical dependency in relation to another who would not be as individual as he is. Yeah, I think it's all fairly clear. Blanchot then starts to seek another model of the relation between self and other, a model other than its equality, other than human imminency. So he's also looking for another model of what it is to be human. He says, if the relation of man with man ceases to be that of the same with the same, equality, but rather introduces the other as irreducible and, given the equality between them, always in a situation of dissymmetry in relation to the one looking at the other, between that radical awareness, then a completely different relationship imposes itself and imposes another form of society which one would hardly dare call a community. And again, both Bataille and Monchot in their work talk about community as being the absence of community, the community of those who dare not. So rather than equality, the principle of human insufficiency is being raised. Blanchot, quoting Bataille, says there exists a principle of insufficiency of the unit of each being. We're not talking about that Platonic model of where the male and the woman have to join together and form one whole. We're talking about something else. The awareness of the insufficiency arises from the fact that it puts itself in question. Which question needs the other or another to be enacted? In other words, in order for I, to exist, I question. And this questioning goes towards another person, and I need that other person for my questioning. I need another person not to be recognized. I need the other person in order to answer me back, in order to throw my questions at another person. As Blanchot says, a being does not want to be recognized, it wants to be contested. In order to exist, it goes towards the other, which contests and at times negates it, so as to start being only in that privation that makes it conscious. Herein lies the origin of consciousness. Not quite so.
of the impossibility of being itself. I do not exist in myself. I exist in myself, questioning and going towards the other. And the other being radical other is not the same as me. He tests me. This way, it will perhaps exist, experiencing itself as an existence shattered through and through. This is because it's not like the college plays, which you know. As an existence shattered through and through, composing itself only as it decomposes itself, constantly, violently, and in silence. Okay? So this insufficiency is not derived from a model of sufficiency. I'm not looking to be fulfilled. I'm not looking to be made whole. It is not looking for what may put an end to it, but for the excess of a lack that ever grows deeper and deeper, even as it fills itself up. And of course, you reject your mind. We are looking to increase the lack, to keep questioning. And this model of existence that can be dependent on questioning is something I think pretty much question these days when we see the Bush and Company model of education coming out of the teaching of values. And I propose these issues right now at 40%. There's no way, according to Blanchot and Bataille, to get beyond this questioning. There's no chance of communion or of transcendence. If you like, we're in the ancient world. Okay, Blanchot then asks, what cost, if we're looking for consciousness, he asks, and this consciousness depends on this being contested by the other, he asks, what calls to that which will make arise the deepest consciousness? What calls me into question most radically? And his answer is that it's the experience of death. Not of my death, but of the death of the other. The death of the friend, the death of the lover. The experience of someone else's death. Bataille says, a man alive who sees a fellow man die can only survive beside himself. And if you remember Rambo's statement, I is plenty. And this experience of death, this being beside oneself, is what bounds community. According to Jean Luc Nancy, death itself is the true community of mortal beings. Their impossible community. The community therefore occupies the following singular space. It takes upon itself the impossibility of its own imminence. Again, I mentioned the various creatures today. The impossibility of communitarians being a subject. In a way, the community takes upon itself and inscribes in itself the impossibility of community. That is, the minute the community starts moving towards communion, it starts dissolving itself. It starts dissolving its own questioning and doubt, and therefore its own speech, its own existence. And that is the problem of speech in a second. Therefore, any community, true community, is community of absence, is not about self. It gives rise to speech, right, to the other. That's how we talk to the other, that's how we communicate to the other. This speech, that because of radical otherness, is always dissolved and is never understood, is always going into silence, the usual postmodernist phrases. We turn together that wax, slippage. Speech that will always fail. And in this, in this community, say, of loss, of speech that doesn't disappear, but just keeps failing, slipping, dissolving, Bataille and friends began looking for models other than communism and democracy. I'll just say this as directly as I can. And what they did is, especially during the typhoon, three groups, contrary attack, many formed the Alpha Fall and then the College of Sociology. And the second one, the Alpha Fall, we think is where the main work was done. And what he began very much in the Alpha Fall was to look, and the others, because I've seen, et cetera, was to look for other models. And they started looking at myths. And in their looking for myths, Bataille became very fascinated with sacrifice. He saw sacrifice as not killing, but abandoning and giving. Again, it was this idea that the self, when it's moving to the other, the limit always is where there's the dissolve between self and other, and you're in ecstasy, which lasts at the last for a second. Right? So he said about sacrifice, to link oneself with the Alsekval is to abandon and to give oneself wholly to limitless abandonment. I think it's very interesting when you look at Brotherly Knights, which is quite what happens in Brotherly Knights, the center of Brotherly Knights, the relationship between the group and the captain. The gift or abandonment is such that ultimately there is nothing to give or give up, and that time itself is only one of the ways in which this nothing to give offers and withdraws itself in the shape of an absence. Now think for a minute. André Masson, now I have a picture with me, which I wish I had in Leipzig, André Masson, but I'm sure you all of you know it anyway, drew a picture of the Asaphel of God. I think the Asaphel of God was actually the 3rd-4th century of Abraxas. And the picture, and if my memory is right, all right, you have this figure, human figure, of course it's a human figure, but it doesn't really matter. I'll tell you why it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman. First of all, there's no head. There's no head because the logos must be put off. Okay. The highest point, and this is what I don't remember, I think it's the right hand. The highest point is a hand, which I say is the right hand, holding a flaming heart. And this heart is flaming because the logos has been cut off. The phallic center. And so what you have instead is you have emotional language. You have the passions. And Bataille will speak again and again of the need for emotional language. That's the highest point of the body. The other hand is holding a sword. The purpose of this sword is not to attack or kill another human being. It's to cut off the head. You needed something to cut off the head. Now here is where Bataille differed with Nietzsche. Nietzsche saw the will to power as being central. And Bataille said, no, that leads to necromania and the false position of the centrality of the ego. That you need the sword to call up the logos. You need abandonment, you need sacrifice. This is what he means by sacrifice, and this was his interest in sacrifice. The head is placed, it is sitting in the place of the genitals. That's why I said it doesn't matter if this is a male or a female. According to them, that was the proper place for the logos. The center of the body is the guts. And the tie brings up the story of Ariadne. It's interesting. It's a lot of relations between this and the model of assembly, but then we have a model with these ideas of key energy. Anyway, so when I talk about sacrifice, keep this picture in mind of another model for a human being. This abandonment of the head, this beheading, which should have made possible, according to Blanchot, the endless, lawless unfettering of the passions, can only be accomplished through passions already unfettered. That'll be important when we get to it. So this, we've gone on this existence to the point of language. If we're looking for a relation between self and other, I've said this before, the total dissolving between self and other. I mean, when the title's about a common imprisonment, it's a great one. Where you get something called ecstasy, will only actually exist when that ecstasy, which is not sayable, is recorded, is communicated. And thus the movement from self to other always becomes a movement from other to self, to complete itself, and it completes itself in language. This necessity, this dependence upon communication. If you remember Wuthering Heights, someone's always telling a story to someone else. There's no direct action. There's no direct action. outside a story. This relationship with the unknown, because the one for whom I write, says Groucho, is unknown. The one to whom I talk is unknown. The other is always unknown. This relationship with the unknown, any communication, even in writing, exposes me to death or to finitude. And therefore, communication, which without breaking the isolation, deepens it in a solitude lived in common and bound to an unknown responsibility in regard to the unknown. This communication, this writing, is the basis of community. You see, what I want to talk about is a certain tradition. As I said, the literary tradition, I think here we have the necessity for speech, for this kind of writing, in the community which has no community. So I'm not really watering heights in this language, and I'm going to say in the language. Okay, Wuthering Heights is composed of 34 chapters. This is going to be just a few brief things. There are two formal structures of these chapters. The first is you have two stories in Wuthering Heights. You have the outside narrative, which is told by a narrator named Mr. Lockwood. That part of the book, the outside story, is chapters 1 through 4, almost 1 through 4. It actually starts in the middle of 4. And then chapters 31 through 34. Very symmetrical structure. The other structure of Wuthering Heights is that Wuthering Heights consists of two stories. One is the story of, this is a little bit obvious, one is the story of Kathy and Heath, the first Kathy and Heath book. When Kathy dies, that story ends. That's the first half of the book, chapters 1 through 16. Chapters 17 through 34 concerning Heathcliff's succession, or diverged about Heathcliff, however you want to see it. The book is absolutely symmetrical. Right, so you have two stories, two structures, these distinct truths. Now look at this doubling another way. Look at the names of the women. Catherine, the younger Catherine, and Isabel. Now look at the names of the main men. I'm not dealing with the minor characters, Joseph or Eleanor, or Mary Sue, just the main characters. You have the men. First of all, you have the father, who has no name, simply Mr. Earnshaw. Then you have another nameless character. Heathcliff was only given a name by Mr. Earnshaw when he was allowing the Earnshaw family. He was nameless at birth. And Heathcliff was actually the name of the child who died in birth. Then you have Heathcliff, Hindley, and Hareton. The other two men are Linton and Sunman. You see how the doubling works, just formally. The book works formally on repetition. Looking back to this. Okay, chapter 1, I'm just going to go through the book and let me tell you the story of what I mentioned before. Mr. Lockwood, a nice English gentleman, comes to a place called Wuthering Heights. He's pretending. And he says that he likes me. He meets the person from whom he's renting, Mr. Heathcliff. Mr. Heathcliff strikes a sympathetic chord in him. The book works a bit on irony, this kind of irony. This is the first four chapters, what happens in the first four chapters. The next chapter, you meet Mrs. Heathcliff, who isn't married to Mr. Heathcliff. It becomes very confused. Who are these persons? Someone named Hareton. So you have sort of the Holy Trinity in the beginning of Heathcliff, someone named Mrs. Heathcliff, though she's not this Mr. Heathcliff, Mrs. Heathcliff, and someone named Hareton. And you can't figure out what their relations are, and it gets worse, and there are lots of dogs. And suddenly you realize you're in a maze. And it's very cold at night. It's, you know, it's a cold wash. And there's a snowstorm, and Mr. Lockwood can't get out. And he says, well, how am I going to find my way? And they go, well, you have no way, basically. And he's forced to stay. And if you feel that he's in a maze and he can't figure anything out, and he's forced to stay in this very gloomy house. And then he has a dream. And first of all, he reads a book. And the book is this diary. And then he dreams. And he has two dreams. His first dream, and he's very lost. He doesn't know who these people are, what the relationships are. His first dream is of religion. Lost. And then, after dreaming about God the Father, he has a second dream. And in it, he dreams of Catherine Linton. He is not who Catherine Linton is a child, and she wants to come home. For 20 years, she's been away. She's been isolated. And then he dreams himself as being perverse. He won't let her in. Perverse action, one of the good normal actions for letting some old child who's knocking on your window. But he won't let her in. And so he wakes up from this nightmare, perversity, confusion, and he screams. And Heathcliff comes running down, and Heathcliff talks to, not to Mr. Lockwood, Heathcliff talks to the person that Mr. Lockwood just dreamed about. He talks to Kathy. And he tells Kathy to please come in, which doesn't make any sense at all. And talk to some of the characters in someone else's dream. He's talking to people who don't exist. And we're not sure. And one wonders suddenly, to whom is Emily Bronte? I visited the house Emily and the other Brontes lived in. It's amazing. The moors, I don't know how many of you have seen them. They're, you go up, and suddenly you're in flat land, and there's nothing there. There's one road, and that's it. People that live lost in the moors all the time. They're not the ones that are ancient. And I feel like we're in the beginning of the world. It's amazing. It's immense, non-moving space. Endless field. And the house in which they lived in was tiny. Most of the rooms were barely big enough to hold a bed. And it turned out that it was this man, the brother Bronte. Yeah. He lived in the same room as the father. I mean, they had no space. You have a feeling of total claustrophobia, nobody to talk to, and you end this non-human wars. And no wonder. Anyway, so he wakes up from the dream and he goes back to his tent in his locker. And then begins the story within a story. So the outside is just this maze, right? You don't know what's happening, these strange things. Dreams of the wall. Now, in the middle of the fourth chapter, we have a different genre. Suddenly, we have the fairy tale. And this is how the fairy tale begins. Once upon a time, there was a father. And the father said to his two daughters, the two children, the daughter and the son, I'm going away. I'd like to bring you some presents. What would you like? And the daughter replies, I'd like a whip. And the son replies, I'd like a fiddle. Now when you get to know the son, whose name is Henry, a little better, you remember what the hell you have to fiddle for. And you just put it all around. And Kathy is perverse even at this age. Anyway, the father, this is the beauty of the beast, right? Beginning of it. And the father goes away and comes back. But the father, and now we have the first twist in the fairy tale, the father comes back with a gypsy. A little brat, who worse than that is not white. Gypsies are not white in nature. Right? And worse than that, the father begins to love this brat more than his own natural son. This brat whose name is Sullen Completion. And then the father gives the brat the name of a son who died of childbirth. The father makes the nameless child someone else. Very important in this book, about making someone into someone else. Okay. 2 years later, the father dies. So much different. Now, we have the results of his action. Since he liked his unnatural son more than his natural one, whose name is Henry, hates the unnatural one. Okay? I mean, really, this part is story. The story within the story is all important. Whereas the daughter, Kathy, who's wild, wicked, sweet, and bonny, right before her father's death, I mean, people are complaining about her behavior. She's too wild. And she doesn't really have any feelings about the fourth woman. He says to her, "Why can't thou be a good lass, Kathy?" And she answers, "Why can't thou be a good father, father?" And in a way, this is all about the father, not being a good father. Okay. Hindley, after the father's death, becomes a substitute father. And he marries what's described as a silly wife, whose name is Frances. So you have the new order, right? You have the perverse action of the father making the unnatural son into the love son. And now you have the new order of the family, which you see the actual substitution. Hindley becomes the substitute father. And in this new order, this new family, hell is beginning to arise. The old father's story. Heathcliff is driven out of the house because he knows. In reaction, Kathy, being wild, this really feels, the minute the father dies, Kathy and Heathcliff feel under the